The work that I'm going to present is about a state health insurance exchange that's really a microcosm, a first step towards the kind of health insurance exchanges that are being created under the Affordable Care Act that was passed in March of 2010. I have several colleagues who worked with me, my research assistant Ben Keeney, who's a recent PhD candidate and about to graduate at the University of Washington, and two colleagues from the Healthcare Authority, which is our administrator of both our basic health plan and also recently our Medicaid Purchasing Administration, and public employee benefits for about 400,000 people. They've been of instrumental help in getting this work done. The purpose of this partnership is really twofold. First, to create a small business exchange. It only deals with small groups, not people in the individual market, offering subsidized health insurance to low-income workers through small employers that do not currently offer insurance. The second purpose is really to form a learning lab, so that we can learn some valuable lessons in preparation for the shop exchanges that start under healthcare reform in January of 2014. We had some specific questions for the evaluation. There are eight of them, and I'll go through them quickly. The first was, did the Health Insurance Partnership, HIP, further its goals of establishing an exchange for a targeted set of small employer groups? They set out a goal of about 100 employers covered and 650 employees and their dependents covered after the first year. So they started small, definitely. That was the goal. We'll compare the goal with the reality in a few minutes. Second question was whether or not the partnership aligned with the significant policy issues that surround healthcare reform and its implementation. If this is a microcosm, if it is a first step, how well does it line up with the aspects of the Affordable Care Act? Third, did HIP, through the provision of health insurance to previously uninsured groups, likely improve the access to health care? And we sometimes conflate health insurance with health care, and we're talking about health insurance here and whether it had an indirect or direct effect on furthering health care access for these folks. The next question, during its application and what turned out to be a truncated enrollment period of 5 months rather than the 3 years that was originally hoped for, and I'll talk about that in a minute, did the HIP bring value, meaning value for money? Was the amount paid in premium sufficiently reflected in risk protection and also access to health care? Did it improve affordability of coverage for these small employer groups? To give you a frame on this, there are about 700,000 uninsured folks in the state of Washington. In the state of Washington, only about 6% of the people insured avail themselves of the individual market. Most of the insured are either covered under public programs or private programs sponsored through employers. So it's a targeted domain here. Fifth question, did the plans that were selected by the board a priori seem to offer adequate and appropriate choice? Or is often the case for small groups where the choice is rather narrow because of concerns about adverse selection on the part of the carriers and narrow enough that they might reflect a fairly high degree of cost-sharing burden for the patients selecting those? And was there appropriate choice in terms of the range of tiers of coverage on offer? Second question, the legislation passed by the state decided to forego individual choice by employees of particular benefits. Instead, the employers chose the tier of coverage, and within that chose the carrier and the particular benefit. So the employees were not given affordable choice in the early part. The employer was given that choice, and then the employees had a limited menu to select from. Was there enough variability? And that was the question. And trying to second guess, after some experience, would the introduction of individual choice with the inception of the legislation and the beginning of enrollment in January of 2011 have made a difference? Would it enhance the pace of enrollment? That's a counterfactual that we can't really answer, but we can speculate about it based on what we found. Sixth question. Did the board decisions likely bring value both to subsidized employees, because there were subsidies in this program, as well as the non-subsidized employees? And what was the level of such enrollment? We have 5 months of experience to share with you, because the program was terminated in May of 2011 as the subsidies from the SHAP program and HRSA disappeared with federal budget cuts. There was originally $34 million on offer, $2 million of that was spent, and then the program was terminated. Okay, and we'll talk about that later. Seventh question, was the board decision-making process transparent and were the options that were presented in terms of insurance plan options and their potential impacts to the various stakeholders, small employers, carriers, brokers, advocates, policymakers. We could well add consumers to that list and providers as well. And that's an issue we can talk about during the Q&A. And were they adequately considered by the various stakeholders? Final, and it's important if this is a learning lab, if it is a first step, what lessons can we draw both for design of the Washington State Health Insurance Exchange going forward? And we hope to have things ready by January of 2013, a year before the program is launched. And what can other states learn from our experience? You've got your Massachusetts, Utah, Connecticut, you name it, all the states that we represent. So we'll talk about that in a bit. This is our logic model. What I want to say about it is essentially it was our way of organizing our thinking. We said, much like Donna Bedian in terms of quality of care, there are structural aspects to this model, there are structural changes being made, there are process changes being made, and the outcomes. We worked from left to right and said, number one, does this legislation alter the interaction between the partnership and carriers? Does it change market structure? Does it alter the subsidy structure? If you go down that list, nothing was changed except the subsidy structure, and to some extent, the stakeholder engagement approaches at the bottom. That's the left-hand side. In the middle, processes were certainly changed. What plan options were on offer to employers were distinctly different, although by legislation they had to be drawn from small group products already on offer. So there were no new plans created. There was a focus on the particular plans on offer. Also, what were the premium levels? We can comment a little bit as I show you the data about what they turned out to be. And what were the rates of employer offer and employer contribution? The legislation required a minimum contribution by employers to qualify of 40%. The prevailing portion of the premium paid by employers in our state for small group coverage is 83%. The idea here was by lowering the employer contribution, get those employers in the business. And the question of whether you can do that by legislation or whether there's a market force that goes in the other direction. Trying at the bottom to generate stakeholder support for HIP enrollment. Did we do a good job in getting out and about to the various constituencies that needed to work on this? Brokers being one, so-called navigators, producers, agents, were they engaged at the level that was needed? Secondly, were the carriers engaged? 16 products were put on offer, 4 in each tier, and 4 of the 5 major carriers in the state of Washington participated in this program. We can talk about whether that was enough. Final outcomes. What was the enrollment level? What was the take-up? Did the small groups, the really small groups, dominate? Short answer, they did. All the ones sold in the first 5 months were to small groups of less than 10 employees. We didn't anticipate that. We didn't predict that, but that's what happened. Was it affordable and sustainable down there in the lower right-hand side? So that's kind of the logic model that we looked at, and we tried to take into account that there are other factors operating in this marketplace. There's the federal support for Medicaid, the basic health plan, that's our BHP. What about federal health reform and the regs coming out? How did that influence decisions? What were the employment and labor market conditions? And Washington State isn't terribly different than the nation. Got about an 8.9% unemployment rate at this point, and manufacturing's been hard hit. Service industry is a little bit insulated. But none of these factors militated in favor of increased success of this program. And what was general economic activity? Our conclusion on the first question, HIP did further coverage, but only modestly. The lower left-hand side is the key. 47 subsidized persons within 5 months. That's not a big hit. 20 non-subsidized persons, again. The income stream of the persons non-subsidized, their income on average of $54,000 is slightly above the median income for manufacturing and skilled workers. The other incomes for those that were subsidized are relatively low. And those, by the way, are the adjusted gross incomes that they report for tax. For groups of one, self-employed individuals, that income can reflect losses that they take on their business. So some of the numbers are lower than they would otherwise be. Yeah. Those categories are, that I've just shown you, are mutually exclusive. That is employees, coverage that accounted for 40, coverage that included spouses and dependents covered another 27, in that case. Okay. The employer contribution, the legislation said a minimum of 40%. Well, sure enough, of those employers that took up the coverage, most of them gravitated toward a contribution toward the insurance premium of 40%. Some 60%, some 50%. The tiers are similarly named to that in the federal legislation. Notice there was nobody in the bronze tier. No employer opted for that level. Very few in the silver tier, and for those in the gold tier and the platinum tier, their levels of contribution were slightly higher. Second question, how well did it align with Affordable Care Act? Key similarities. Both have four plan benefit levels, all the way from bronze, if you will, up to platinum. Both utilize sliding scale premiums per employee based on the federal poverty level criteria, and both provide some form of support for small employers. Affordable Care Act does it via tax credits. HIP did it by lower than prevailing minimum employer contributions. Key differences. At the individual level, HIP only subsidized employer premiums. It did not subsidize cost sharing. So it didn't get at copayments or deductibles. It didn't subsidize those. Affordable Choice has both an individual and an employer mandate. HIP has neither. This was a totally voluntary program. Finally, in terms of key differences, Affordable Care Act includes individual choice of plan at its inception, whereas HIP did not until the third year, which didn't eventualize. HIP did take a first step toward providing coverage for uninsured, low-income persons in small groups. The purpose of this slide is really to show that the total persons covered were pretty well spread across the lowest income bands, 0 to 66% below at the federal poverty level, about two-thirds to one and a third times the federal poverty level, and so on. The total persons, 47 out of 67, were covered with subsidized coverage. Our conclusion about healthcare access is it modestly enhanced healthcare access for low-income persons for the reasons stated there. Didn't affect very many folks. However, the selection of more comprehensive plans mean that cost-sharing levels would likely be relatively low, less than 10% of the total cost. However, for people who are predominantly low income, as you may know, from both looking at the Affordable Care Act and just common standards for affordability, that still might compromise the affordability at the end of the day for these people. Premiums are kept down for sure, very reasonable premiums, but what about the cost sharing, even with relatively comprehensive plans? It's somewhat instructive that 14 of the 16 employers who did offer coverage offered the two highest tiers, comprehensive coverage. They didn't gravitate to either an HSA-type plan, which from the outset there was so little demand for it that it wasn't even included among the tiers. And among the tiers, nobody chose bronze, and only two employers chose the lowest level of the next lowest level of coverage, if you will. How am I doing on time? Couple more minutes? Okay. Value and affordability of coverage for the small groups. Our conclusion was that HIP was beginning to offer affordable value after 5 months, but the end of the subsidies was critical. This time plot just shows the distribution of dependents, spouses, and employees, and that coverage over time. The pace of enrollment by group size, it was all micros. There were 11 employers that signed up and actually got from employer agreement to the first date of coverage within that first three-month period. There were 11 in that period, and there were five more in the two-month period from April to May. So we really didn't have a long enough run on this to give you a good sense of what enrollment would have been, but there was some increasing enrollment over time. Conclusion, the selection of more comprehensive coverage hints that, at least for the micro groups, the groups from 1 to 10 that did take up this coverage and did put it on offer for their employees, there was likely to have been a positive impact on affordability and appropriateness. We think that the premium subsidies did significantly enhance affordability for low-income persons, but our key informant interviews, as well as the data that we see, suggest to us that point-of-service patient cost-sharing might have been a significant barrier, even continuing. And that may have been what scared away some employers from putting this on offer. Take a look at the premiums down here. What I'll comment on is for the single only, or the single coverage for employees, those gold and platinum dollars are about in the range of the average premiums on offer for small groups in the state of Washington. The survey data suggests the average premium, forget about HIP, just in the general market, is about $370 a month for this coverage. Those premiums, at least the gold is a little bit lower, the platinum slightly higher, because those gross premiums are what are the premiums on offer for most business in the state, you didn't see much difference there. You do see that if you're talking about family coverage, and you're talking about a relatively low-income family with, say, $25,000 a year, just take those premiums for family, for the gold and platinum coverage, multiply them by 12, that's a pretty steep premium. Now, it is subsidized, and the level of the subsidy is at about 90% of the available premium remaining after the employer's contributed. So when we did the analysis of the premium hit to the individual, net of the subsidy, net of the employer contribution, it was only about 2% of income. But then, even for these richer coverages, when you simulate what average health expenditures for folks are like under these coverages, you could see as much as 10% of income being spent on this. And for low-income people, the standards that the Urban Institute and others have developed suggest that that's probably an unaffordable premium for most of those folks. Transparency, I'll just quickly say that one thing the healthcare authority did brilliantly, I think, was to be very transparent both to the larger public and to the immediate stakeholders. If you take a look at the website of the healthcare authority and the health insurance partnership in particular, there is a wealth of data and transparency about every committee meeting, every bit of analysis that was done. You can really see these numbers in bold relief. The lessons learned, one of the things that slowed enrollment, probably brought it close to a halt in addition to the absence of subsidies, was that carriers in the state of Washington decided in March to suspend compensation for brokers for micro groups, groups of 1 to 9. Well, of course, that's exactly the group that initially took this up. And if you're not paying brokers to serve that market, and it's a tough market for them to reach in the first place, how much penetration are you going to get? So dealing with different ways of compensating brokers and making sure that you recognize that as an explicit cost of offering insurance is key. Maybe we need some alternative arrangements where the carriers aren't paying the brokers, but somehow public support is provided so that they're neutral as between the different sides of the transaction. Also, we've got to actively market plan options to small groups and individuals. There's a lot of inertia in this market, and behavioral economics says you've got to somehow shock people from the status quo, right? And if it was somehow that you had to opt out of having insurance rather than opt in it, which is, of course, what the mandate provides, that helps a lot. Short of a mandate, we have to be a little bit clever in designing these things and putting them on offer. Finally, I also felt that the next step is to establish sustainable funding for both the income-related patient cost-sharing subsidies and the insurance premium subsidies. I think everybody agreed in our state when those subsidies were eliminated by HRSA and SHAP because of federal budget cuts, the agency people certainly didn't want that to happen, but they had to be responsible. That really killed it. And so that's a simple lesson. You don't need to be a health services researcher to see that. But it is an important contextual remark. Finally, I think the underlying complicating health insurance reform factor is probably the failure to control costs and to improve value of health services. If even after you subsidize the insurance to the tune of 90% of a residual premium, so the employee only has to pay 10%, and you get the employer contribution down by legislative mandate to 40%, if you're still left with people spending 10 or 12% of their income who are at the lower end of the income spectrum, that's unaffordable for most of those people, at least as a predictable expenditure over time. So we've got to do something about the cost bogey to really make progress on this question. And insurance design isn't going to fully do that. And to get at that, we've got to catalyze the carriers to be busier about contracting selectively with providers. We've got to activate consumer choice with the sort of side-by-side comparisons that Enthoven and others have talked about for years. And we need to encourage some honest provider competition on value and cost. But even as an economist, I don't want to overstate what I think we'll get from competition. It may be that working wisely and heartfully and thoughtfully is going to get us a lot further than being hard-hitting with our economic incentives. But we do have to get our hands around cost somehow and value. Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel members. That was a great overview, I think, of the importance of health services research and supporting health policy decisions, both at the local and state and federal levels. And it was nice that Ruth asked everybody in the room what your engagement was in this area of health services research. And I think that the panel represents a nice range of people that brought your attention to the administration's implementation of a congressional intent specifically around the patient navigator model and evaluation of that program. Ruth's really bringing to your attention the importance of research methodologies and bringing those to the table when communities are beginning to discuss what is important in the context of health policy decisions. And Kathy, in the context of the resource constraints that face every healthcare provider, whether it's a system or an individual practitioner, and the decisions that they make on behalf of their patients and hopefully with their patients and their caregivers. And then Doug's really good evaluation of an element of the Affordable Care Act that can readily be implemented at the local level if people really pay attention to how that implementation meets the needs of the community. And sometimes at the federal level, we're not really good about doing that. The local level and the interest and the needs assessment of the local level isn't always reflected at the federal level. So I would like to just ask them quickly to share with you kind of the takeaway message that they would like you to leave this room with today in regard to their issue area, and if they're comfortable in general about the importance of health services research, and then we'll get to your questions. So Kyle, if you'll just...
Yeah, I think that for my presentation at least, I think that it's kind of a smaller piece of a larger process that this administration and focus that this administration is placing on the importance of evaluation for the types of programs that are coming through and are being implemented by agencies like HRSA. So I think that increased and renewed focus on program evaluation and health services research more specifically is important and certainly a focus of this administration.
Thanks.
Well, I'd love to know what you guys thought the takeaway message was, because I know what was important to me. But I would hope that predominantly the use, if you're collecting data, don't stop at percent representation, move it to the next level, find yourself a statistician, somebody who has the knowledge base, and work with them.
Well, like Ruth and the others, I'm very interested in what your thoughts are. I guess one takeaway is, when you design a program like Washington State did, make sure that you've thought about the end game and the current market context. One thing I didn't mention was that the HIP that I described was actually put on hold once. It was actually scheduled to be initially enacted in 2009. And the folks looked at it then at the Healthcare Authority and said, you know what, I don't think the dollars are there. It's a tough time. This was after the financial crisis had hit a year before. They held off. And then, 2010, 2011, they said, let's go for it. You know, we've got to do something here. And we discovered that those subsidies were absolutely critical. Because when that 90% is covered by somebody else stopped, and when the brokers were no longer getting paid to hustle the really smallest of the small groups, bingo, program's dead. So we've got to think about sustainable. If we're going to start something like this, we better finish it. You know, I think stuff in the Affordable Care Act, the public finance of that isn't terribly strong. I mean, it's borrowing a lot of money from a lot of places without a coherent revenue source. And I think it's a reflection of our times. The that we can't be honest with each other about where the money's really got to come from. I think we found some of those lessons in microcosm in Washington State.
I think for my study, I mentioned this, looking through the literature, things seem to focus on race, and, in large part, you have to think about the reality and the day-to-day operations of a hospital. It's pretty much all around resource constraints. So I'm always somewhat disappointed when I look at studies and they don't have any facility-level measures in there to try and get some idea of really what's going on at the facility level that may be impacting the relationships that you're seeing. Now, granted, our database doesn't get as many safety net burden facilities as we thought, because there's a cost associated with being an American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer accredited facility. You get reviewed every 3 years, you have to pay a fee, you have to employ a cancer registrar, and some have more than one, and it is expensive. And so, that's somewhat of a downside. But, even so, there's enough in our database that we're able to take a look at it. So, I'd like to continue. We'd love to hear your comments.
And we would love to hear your comments. You have a great panel. You are the relevant and important components to making sure that our healthcare system meets the needs of individuals and communities, and you have a great resource right in front of you. So what are your questions? Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask Ruth about the structure of the health system. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about, is there an FQHC? Is it available after 5? Is it overloaded? Because their preferences would be affected
yes.
by the structure of the health system.
Well, yeah, there is. There are several safety net clinics. Two of them actually pull down federal funds. It's an interesting market, and there are rotating hours. There could be better integration. There is definitely a little bit of push-pull, even for a market that is not, financially self-sustainable. There's still competition for patients. But then one of the hospitals opened an intermediary type of a clinic, which is open until like 10 or 11 at night.
In our town, we have an FQHC but because the FQHC charges the copay, the income still use the hospital. I mean, in Iowa, they go to the hospital and got the busiest safety in the state above Chicago in a town of 120,000 because of the structure of the system.
And the focus group research I've done around that shows that, low income uninsured people, they want the same thing that insured people want. They want. And emergency department care is perceived as higher quality
right.
than the services offered
at
the safety. Yeah.
Yes.
Certainly, resources for behavioral mental health are very limited in the settings that our grantees come from. Oftentimes, when you have comprehensive FQHCs, which many of the initial grantees were, they have mental behavioral health departments and clinicians on staff, but their resources are very limited. There certainly was an effort to integrate those systems as much as possible, but if it doesn't exist in the existing system, the clinic or the community health center where that patient is from, trying to find external resources, like I said, access to any kind of specialty care for these populations is very difficult. Sure. No. There certainly is. I think that there is an ongoing debate about what the difference between a community health worker and a patient navigator is. Certainly, patient navigators, and I think about 40% of our patient navigators that were hired through this program had formal community health worker training. So there certainly is overlap in those roles. And I think that actually Massachusetts community health workers are doing a lot of interesting work about really definitizing where there can be overlap and where there is difference. So it's kind of an ongoing discussion.
So one question is, because it is on everyone's mind these days, and the sustainability issue, like when the funding runs out, is there any possibility that it can be integrated into the system? A, there are cheaper, obviously, and clinicians.
I mean, there's certainly a lot of interest around showing that patient navigators provide a cost benefit to a clinic. It is long term, though. You're not going to see it up front. You're actually probably going to see a cost increase because you're bringing patients into care who weren't into care previous to that. So it's long term. There's really no study that you can point to and say, yes, there is cost effectiveness there, but there's a lot of work being done in that area and there's a lot of interest in that area. It's something that we didn't tackle in our particular program the first time around, but they've integrated some smaller elements of it in the second with the second cohort of grantees. So.
Yes, ma'am.
Regarding that, so you mentioned already like that bar of getting certification, and so you're missing some, facilities that way.
Right.
Did you also see you had some data elements required that I'm wondering if that missing data for which those patients were discarded was variable by facility too? For the tumor stage, I thought, patients who are more frail or have a lot of comorbidities or maybe certainly overwhelmed, resource constrained environment, you might have lost a large portion of those patients. So I was wondering maybe the missing data question, if that happened in actual.
Yeah, we took a look actually at some of the missing data. In large part, there wasn't a lot in any one category.
Oh.
So, it didn't seem like they were different in any way. But that all could have been, the system was such a small number, we wouldn't have found a difference even if it was there. One thing that, I didn't mention in terms of limitations, we weren't able to, for example, tell if someone did not receive cardiac clearance for surgery. We just knew they didn't get surgery. So I went back into the data and I selected anyone that had any kind of a heart condition and I took them out and I just reran them all. I just assumed, they were contraindicated for surgery perhaps, took them out and then reran them all. It didn't make any difference. And then I thought the same thing for people with problems with pulmonary function. If they had severely decreased pulmonary function, you probably wouldn't want to do surgery on them either. So I got about 300 of those, so I took them out. Same thing, no difference with the model. The other thing that was kind of odd was in the comorbidities. We had kind of a large number of people that were showing as zero comorbidities, but zero in the coding manual actually says no documented comorbidities or none. So what I did is I took a look to see if those patients that didn't undergo surgery had a higher level of no documented comorbidities, and we saw a slightly higher level. And so our interpretation is that if you didn't go on for surgery, then you didn't get worked up to the same extent, and so we didn't collect this exhaustive list of comorbidities. Because once you get past the zero category, then the pattern you expect to see makes sense.
Any last quick question? I'd be conscious. Sure.
Well,
okay.
I think it's really like your study. It's more of a comment because I think really, you know, what is really behind this kind of ambiguous race factor that we kind of all just kind of throw into the study as a variable, and we're not really sure what we're measuring there. And so I really kind of appreciate that. And, you know, there was just an article really looking at place is really more important than race there, too. So I was just wondering, from your perspective, is, are people starting to kind of look beyond race and really what does race mean and how does that impact?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great really question. Important question. It's one of the things that, you know, prompted me to begin this in the first place. What I'd like to do is really try, you know, try this out, this particular model of scheme and so forth, on other cancer sites to see if this plays out. I'd also like to do it with more years of data to see if, you know, a greater N would change any of the relationships once we stratify by race, controlling for all these facility level characteristics.
Kathy, did you have a question?
I just had a question about the stakeholder study, patient navigator study, because the Cancer Society, you know, patient navigators are a big thing. It's something that we're trying to provide more of, not just the training, but actually trying to fund patient navigators at the various American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer accredited facilities, because it's now part of the standard. Have to have a navigator, and the facilities are all panicking because, oh, this is going to be more cost. Right now they have a nurse kind of doing it, or they have a person covering three different hospitals that's running around trying to do navigation. So my question for you was, for the, your study, was each navigator dedicated to a facility full time? How did that work?
It depended on the site that they were in. Actually, the grantees got to decide that. But I would say probably 75% of navigators were full-time at a single location. The rest of them were either part-time or moved between multiple locations. But they did kind of shake out to an average caseload of somewhere between 50 and 150 patients per navigator. So that was more of the standard that we used versus full-time, part-time.
And that's a number per week, per month, the caseload? Or just total?
Just total caseload.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's just one thought that, you know, I teach in Master of Public Health program, different programs, and what I think was fascinating about the selection process for this is that if everybody at this table and people doing research like we do were together and took more of a systems perspective, looking at the interrelationship, because each one of these studies tells part of the truth, but together I think we get a lot more insight into what are long-term doable solutions rather than just pieces here and there.
Well, thank you, Ruth. I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that the relevance and importance of your work is becoming more and more clear as we move towards an evidence-based policy development process and the breadth of opportunities for your research to have an impact is not going to decrease over time. So share with each other and work collaboratively as much as you can, because really this is an important issue. Whether we do it through the Affordable Care Act or whether you do it through your local community, people are going to come and ask you what's the best way to do this, and if you have the relevant information, you will really be a real champion for the patients and the communities that you're engaged with. So if you'll just another round of applause for our panel up here. And thank you for your attendance. I hope you enjoy the rest of the meeting.